Today is July 25th. My name is Karen Hebert, and I'm here with Mike Davis in Dillingham, Alaska. And we are speaking with Robin and Ofi, although I'll give them a chance to introduce themselves. Maybe you could start off by saying your full name, the date and place you were born, and where you spent some of your early years.
My name is Yelmer Olson. I was born at Kanakanak Hospital in the fall of 1939 to a family that was to be eventually 11 children, and grew up at Kanakanak, had a BIA school down there, went a year to school there, and my family moved back to the Worry River in 1946, and I stayed with my aunt up at the Fisherman's Co-op store and went to school there for a year. And most of the time I spent at Kanakanak. 1940, my dad was trapping up in Lewis Point, in that big slough southwest of Lewis Point, and we stayed there a winter. And then after that, we were up in the Nacho. Same thing, trapping beaver in the spring. I don't remember those years. I was too young. But I guess the village was there then. And then they closed the BIA school at Kanakanak. And my dad went to a Catholic priest, relatively new here, Father Endall, and asked him to teach school at Kanakanak. And so he agreed to do it, and I went to school there 2 years at Johnny Nicholson's house. There must have been 15 kids there or so. It was really, I really learned a lot. He was a good priest, Father Endall. And then he went and built a mission uptown. Of course, the school was closed then, and then we were bused to Dillingham for the school.
Yes, my name's Robin Samuelson. I was born in 1951 here in Dillingham. I grew up in the city of Dillingham in Kanakanak. Ofi is my uncle, so Ofi and I were... besides being related, we're involved in fishing throughout a number of years. I started off in the fishery as a young boy helping his grandma's set net. And then we'll get into what I did later on in the fishery.
Sounds good, Robin. Ofi, I was wondering if you could speak to some experiences that you had maybe early on in your life and also even throughout your life that you think have most shaped your perspectives on resource issues here in Bristol Bay, whether fishing or a whole range of other activities, whatever you'd like to talk about.
Well, I think fishing was to be my whole life. Started off in 1948 down in about 2 miles below Kanakanak. My dad had a sit-net site there. And 1947. And then they closed it down, moved the limit stake. That was the north limit stake. But they have sit-nets all the way up by Dillingham. So when they closed it, my dad moved to Igushik, 1948, and we were set netting there. We had a year or two after we moved down, that dad got 3 set net sites, my mom and my dad and me. And from there, I guess, you kind of catch the bug and start fishing in a skiff later. And then eventually in a drift gillnet boat. fishing was then pretty well ingrained in me. And fished every year. And it was a pretty good life, I thought. When I got old enough, we trapped a little bit in the wintertime, mostly beaver. But
where'd you do
that's
that?
What people done around here a long time ago. They either fished or fished and trapped.
Where'd you go trapping?
Lower Nooshigak River or behind Kanakanak. Yeah.
Robin, what about you?
I started off, as I stated earlier, sitting in Snake River with my two grandmas. I was a fish packer, fish puller. I remember I couldn't even lift fish. So I'd put a rope to their gills and I'd pull them up to the where we were storing them on the beach and then wash. There was a creek there and we'd wash them and throw them in a skiff. There was my two grandmas, my sister, who's 1 year older than me, Wasley O'Keenock, and my other uncle, Pete Olson, would come in with his boat. But started off set netting and eventually started fishing with my father as a young crewman and learning how to fish. He was fishing for Bendixson, Bendixson's cannery. East Point Seafoods no longer operating in Bristol Bay. And then in about 1965, I started fishing as a young 13, 14-year-old. I started fishing a 22-foot Seymour skiff by myself. 75 fathoms a gear. I rented the skiff from Queen Fisheries. I bought a used motor and my dad gave me gear. And from there, I graduated into a fish boat. And once I had kids, I named my boat Robin Darlene, and it's been that way for about 32 years now. But most of my life I've fished and didn't do much trapping until later on in life, but I did go trapping. I worked during the winters, tried to find employment and various jobs. It's in Dillingham.
And what about hunting? Did you do a lot of that, both of you, growing up?
Yeah, I hunted with my dad, my uncles. I really wanted to go hunting when I was a young kid. And we used to go with a skiff to the lower river and hunt moose. Never saw any caribou until the later years. Hunted ducks and geese. And hunted a lot of ptarmigan behind Kanakanak. My dad, dog team, it was dog team back then, no snow machines. Didn't even know snow machines was coming into existence. But it was nice as a young person. I'd drive and my dad would sit in the sled and shoot ptarmigan. Of course, I had to run and go pick him up. Yeah. Yeah, that moose hunting up. Pretty good. Usually got a moose every year. There was a few hunters, but don't seem like there was as many as nowadays. You know, Dillingham back then was probably 700 people, maybe 600 people. But now there's 2,400 people. Mm. So the competition gets pretty fierce. Yeah. Yeah, we used to stay in them. There was cabins all over upriver. Usually went a little above Portage Creek there. There was a cabin there and a cabin a few bends above that. Another cabin above that. Went in a cock walk, there was another cabin. So we carried a tent, but fortunately we camped in those cabins. It was more comfortable.
Sounds like. How about you?
The ideal world to live in back then was fishing in the summer, hunt in the fall for a big game like moose, and then live a subsistence lifestyle throughout the winter. And a lot of people did that, all up and down the river, both the Nishiac River and Wood River. We had people camping out. I was fortunate. I got one of the first snow machines in Dillingham because I had rheumatic fever and I couldn't walk for about half of the month. So my dad, after a few people got snow globes, he ordered me an 8-horsepower snow machine with the engine in the back. And it was a piece of junk because it kept getting stuck. But if you wanted to ride with me, then you had to push me out of the snowbank. So I usually had a bunch of kids running after me that whenever I got stuck, they'd push me out and I'd give them a little ride. But I think the population back then, Ophi, was about 400, 450, I think.
More like, yeah. And,
yeah.
What year do you think that, what year
are you talking? This is the early 60s.
Yeah.
And everybody knew everybody. And Olsonville was a really big place. Mm. There was a lot of people that lived in Olsonville. That was original Dillingham. Mm. And my relatives had a store down there, and they kept getting their freight mixed up between Dillingham, where we know Dillingham now, and Kanaknack. And finally they named Dillingham Snake Point, and then eventually Dillingham, and then Kanaknack. But there was stores down in the post office was down Kanaknack, main stores were down Kanaknack, and then it all slowly transferred up to Dillingham, the center of town as we know it today.
Maybe we could talk a bit more about the canneries that were operating at the time and how those changed things in the summer when they started to operate and how you were involved in work for them.
Okay. Well, I think I'm one of the fortunate ones at my age to see a cannery built from scratch and being a major processor in the bay to virtually nothing right now.
Mm.
There's nothing left of that cannery but some few old buildings. Queen Fisheries came here in the late 40s on a floating processor and then bought some land and started out building Queen Fisheries. So I think it was a two-line cannery. But when I was young, they had two canneries operating uptown. It was PAF and the Bristol Bay Packers, where Bristol Alliance is now. And across the river was Clark's Point, that was Alaska Packers, and then down in Eacock was Libby McNeil and Libby. That was the four canneries that was operating here. Of course, there was more over in Anaktiquijack. But eventually they were all operating at full swing. They both had a bunch of boats. You know, 1951 we converted to power. And I think Clark's Point closed about 1950, 51, somewhere in there. Of course, Bristol Bay Packers uptown here, and where Bristol Lions that closed in the late 40s, I think it was. So there was two majors, and then, of course, Queen Fisheries was building, and they were eventually become a major operator. They had a pretty big fleet. I think they had well over 100 and some boats, and we fished there for many, many years, Queen Slough. I fished one year with my dad in a sailboat in 1952. He bought a sailboat from Bristol Bay Packers for, I think he paid $200 for that boat. And allowed to use power, so he had an outboard motor and a bracket on the side. When it was calm, we used the motor, and when it was windy, he used the sail. And And that was, we didn't know that power was going to come in to what it is today. The people voted for power in 1951. And now the little sailboats look like canoes alongside some of the size of these boats here. And in early days, you had to work at the cannery in the springtime. Of course, I didn't have to. I did it early in my later years, but it was a requirement back there. You had to work run money, they call run money. 2 weeks getting the cannery ready, which entails hanging nets, painting the boats, working around the cannery. And then in the fall, the fishermen had to load the salmon, canned salmon. And I remember down at Clark's Point, they had these rollers. They were about 16, 14 inches wide, I guess, all the way from the warehouse down to the end of the dock. And then they had a chute down there to a flat scow. And the ladies, women had to work too, if they were fishermen. They were pushing those cases. And then the men down on the scow, and then they had a ship crew. Alaska Steam came in here and hauled all the salmon out. And some people were working on the ship crew. And some people lightering back and forth on the tenders, and then the women pushing salmon on these rollers. So it was pretty busy. It was, of course, we never knew that. You couldn't predict the future. Now, Clark's Point is closed. Ecock's got a small filleting operation, I guess. And Peter Pan has got a filleting line and a can line, H&G too. And then Icicle, which is came in here in the late 70s, they just bought Snowpack. Well, they came in here in 78, I think, in cash buy, and a year or two later they brought the Arctic Star and the Bering Star in here. But they mothballed them this year, I guess, and bought an onshore processor. So we have one, two, three operations. Of course, Trident hauls all their fish to Naknek. I think they don't have a processor here anymore. They had a processor early years. But they handle a lot of fish. Yeah. But years ago, it was all canned. All canned. We used to play around the canneries, and if we got hungry, we'd just go grab a can. Now, if you grab a can, hey, you get arrested, I guess. Yeah.
Those are great stories. So, Robin, maybe you could talk a bit about your involvement in the canneries when you were younger, and also how how they've changed, those businesses today.
Yeah, well, my family fished for Bendix, and my mother worked in, and my grandma worked in the cookhouse. And Bendix, and my first job was putting cans of salmon in the case, because Bendix, and he was a low ball operator, and he was growing his cannery, and he didn't have a packer. So what he'd do is hire all of us kids. And at that time, there was no laws against kids working. I mean, 8, 9, 10, 11, we worked 16 hours a day for the cannery. And they'd come over with these big things of canned salmon that was in them and dump them on the floor. And we'd be there with cases and had to load the cases of salmon and ship them out. But my family goes back to one of the first canneries in Nishigak. John W. Clark was a great, great, great grandfather of mine. And he started one of the first canneries over there above Nishigak. And he had a saltery at Nishigak. He had a saltery down at Clark's Point before the cannery was built at Clark's Point, and he had another one down in Igiak, and he ran a Alaska commercial store. My grandma, Mary Olson, she started a processing plant down at Kanaknak. In fact, an hour ago, the reason why I was late, I drove over to Olsonville along the beach, and here's the big old retort that's getting ready to go over the bank. I'm going to pick it up once it goes over the bank and store it in my yard as an ornament, because it was my grandma's retort. And but there was when I was a kid growing up, there was a lot of discrimination against us mm-hmm. locals. We were known as the mud people. And there was a lot of discrimination in the canneries if we were local. Locals didn't get new boats. Locals got used nets. The outsiders got the new nets. The boats were, some of them were pretty dangerous from what I understand. That was hand-me-down boats. When the outsider said the boat was too dangerous for them, they made the local guys go fish for them. And I grew up in that arena of my dad married my mother. My dad was from Bethel originally, and married my mother and moved over here and became a fisherman. Started fishing at Clark's Point in a sailboat, and realized that the locals were really getting taken by the canneries, especially when fishermen were put on limits. Outsiders were given one set of numbers, might be 8,000 pounds, and if you were local, you got 5,000 pounds. And at that time, and this was before the Japanese decimated our runs in Bristol Bay, there was quite a few fish. And a lot of the jobs that were in the canneries were cannery workers from here to Nome. The airlines flew in cannery workers, hundreds and thousands of cannery workers, both in Naknek, all the canneries in Bristol Bay. They were the backbone workforce, and they brought their machinists and technical people up. And when limited entry happened in 1973, them cannery workers were no longer existent. That's when we started getting college kids. That's when we started getting the green cards rolling into Bristol Bay. And the reason why is one of the main producers in Bristol Bay said, we can't have native cannery workers in a cannery and have native fishermen that will go on strike. Because once some native fishermen go on strike, the native cannery workers will quit processing our fish. So we got to get rid of them native cannery workers and bring in the green cards and the college kids and whatnot. And 1 year's time, the cannery workers from Bristol Bay all the way up to Nome were done. And it was pretty hard on the people from AYK and Kuskokwim, because a lot of them people were coming down here like 15, 20, 25 years. And we knew them in different canneries. We knew who they were. They were our friends. But it was a rough road there for a while for us here in Bristol Bay. Just trying to be canneries having us treated equal. I mean, if you were a non-native, you ate in the blue room. If you were native, you ate in the mud room. I mean, the food was completely different in both places. They cooked real good food for white people. Natives didn't get that good of food. I mean, there's all kinds of little things that you don't see today that happened back then. And that was standard practice. Down at Bendixson's place there was Norwegians that fished for him, and a good group of native fishermen that fished for him. And Bendixson was a Norwegian himself, I think. And a lot of the folks, locals that went down there and fished, is because Bendixson treated them fairly. As an independent small processor up against the giants in Bristol Bay, he always tried to treat us fair. We still called him a damn crook, though.
Do you have stories from this time?
Well, when Clark's Point was operating, my grandpa was night watchman down there in these later years. He was about mid-70s, I think. And I was a young person, and we had a camp. We had a, lived there for a while my parents worked in the cannery. But I'd walk around with him. He had this, he was a night watchman, and I guess for insurance requirements, he had to press a key on a time clock throughout different stations in the cannery. And they had two mess halls down there, just as imagine what kind of operation they had. Two mess halls. They had one out in the front of the cannery there where the machinists and superintendent and a beach gang, I guess, all ate there. And in the back of the cannery was the native mess hall. And the mess halls were open night and day. And I remember two women that were there. Every time I went there with my grandpa, they'd stuff a bag full of pastry. They had a night bake. Most of these canneries had a night bakery and a cook, and you know, it was a big operation. And they cut all that out. I think Queen Fisheries were the last to feed their fishermen when you made a delivery. That was in the 70s.
Early
70s. And then they cut it out altogether. But shortly after the bay went to power here, to get a voice for the fishermen, Robin's dad, he was one of the organizers, and several other fishermen organized what they call the Western Alaska Co-op Marketing Association, WACMA. And at one time, I think they had about approaching 350 members. Well, just one instance, in 1970, we went to Nacniquijack to fish. And it was a big, there was Red Salmon Cannery, CRPA, Ecock, and Queen Fisher's was in that combine too. Custom canning, I guess. But there was a lot of fish over there. Oh, every day Brendel would come out, and there was no fish and game regulating that time. Every day he'd come out and tell us when to fish, what kind of limit we had. One time he came out, and he said, all boats from Rishigat are on 1,350 fish limit. But if you go back to the Rishigat, you get a 2,000 fish limit. Well, we didn't want to go home. There was a little bit fish here, but we wanted to catch a full limit over there, take advantage of the fish over there. And so many of us stayed. A couple of boats went home, but I stayed. And after fishing, the WACMA board got affected some people in this bay too. Set netters who were set netting over here. My dad was one of them. So they hired an attorney, and they took the processors to court, and they won. So the processors had to pay us for the days that they lowered our limit. So WACMA was a real good association. I wish it would be in existence today.
So maybe we can start talking about some of the biggest changes to the fishery that you've seen over the years, and also, you know, how different groups like WACMA were organizing, both to see those changes happen and maybe fight against those changes. I guess you can sort of start anywhere, what you see as the biggest changes and how different groups of people were involved here in those.
Well, I think the biggest change that ever happened is the advent of limited entry. And there were studies done on the amount of permits that we needed to conduct this fishery. Lo and behold, we ended up with 1,000 sentinel permits and 1,800 drift permits, which was way, way above the standards that they said we were going to have. They said we were going to have a heck of a lot less. So if you're a sentineler, you know, with 1,000 sentinels in Bristol Bay, just about all the districts, fishing districts, has an overcapacity of sentinels. And with 1,800 drift boats, just too many boats were involved in fishery. And we used to be able to survive on 2 to 3 million fish coming into the Nishigak. Now we can't even survive on that because there's too many boats. There's too many permits. And now we're having a negative effect with permit stacking. Most of the boats that are permit stacked, I have dual permits, but most of the boats, local watershed boats, are single permit. And I can cork a single permit boat out 10 times out of 10 on 10 sets. And so it's having a negative effect on the locals. But the biggest issue that ever happened was, to me, was in my fishing time, was limited entry. Mm. Seeing limited entry come in.
What about UFA? What do you think is the biggest change?
I think limited entry was made the most dramatic change. It affected the Bristol Bay region. When we first became a state, the ADF&G, Fish and Game, managed on a cycle, 5-year cycle. They said the fish was going to come back every 5 years. And it did for a while. 1960 was a big season over in the Kwajak, year two, I guess. And 65 was a big year. But I think 1965, I'm not sure about this, but I think 1965 had a bigger run as we had this year, 2013. We'd have to research that. 1970 was another good year. And I think in 1965 there was 1,250 drift permits, 1,300. And in 1970 there was a little less, not much less. And along comes limited entry a few years later, and they didn't say there was going to be an optimum number, but they said those who are in the fishery should be able to make a living fishing. I agree with that statement, but it didn't turn out that way. For example, pre-limited entry, there was 350 set nets in the whole bay. Ugashik, Igigig, Naknikwijak, and here, and probably Togiak was counted maybe. 350 set nets. Like now, or even earlier, you could have gone to Nishigak or Clark's Point, and usually those limit stake set nets were there, 2 or 3 set nets. And you lay out there and you could drift to Clark's Point, clear net. Same one with Coffee Point. I think there was one family down there, drift all the way to the point. Along comes limited entry and they said, we're gonna have an optimum 800 permits. Well, we wound up with 1,100 set nets. So the state can cry and talk about this buyback system, but I think the state of Alaska's at fault for issuing all these permits. In the 60s, pre-limited entry, there was almost every year there's an accident here, but we had a storm, and a boat turned over outside of Ecock, and the people drowned on it. And limited entry years come by, a year or two after limited entry, and I noticed a stranger. I says, "How'd you get a permit?" And they said, "Remember that boat out here that drowned it? Our relatives was on there. We got their permit." 6-7 years after their dead people were getting permits. So I think the state of Alaska is liable for something, this reduction in permits. There's way too many permits. 1,800 and some permits plus 1,100 set nets. The pie is going to be divided into smaller pieces. And now we have a year like this year, which was a year like years ago, and it was probably been a good year. There's so many permits. Not too many people make money.
How also did limited entry change the relationship between the fishing fleet and the processors?
Well, if you got a limited entry permit, you almost got a credit card with the company. They want the effort because they're not going to issue any more. I don't think the state is going to issue any more permits. And they want every effort they had because they want the volume. You know, Trident, Icicle, Peter Pan, they want the volume. And I think Peter Pan and Trident's probably got the majority of the permits fishing for them.
What was the question?
I said, we can take a break soon. How has limited entry changed the relationship of the fishing fleet to the processors?
Well, I think I'd concur with OFI. Depends upon the runs, though.
Mm.
If there's a big run forecasted, the processors know they're going to get their fish. And if there's a small run forecasted, they need to have as many permits fishing for them as possible because they got to cover their CapEx, their overhead, and operating the cannery. And operating the cannery is very expensive. It takes, I think Peter Pan spends $1 million just turning the key on. That's before any canning operations happen. And it's kind of weird. Some years the companies are really looking for fishermen, and some years they won't take any fishermen. We've seen that in just the last few years. And some of the old habits of the canneries are hard to break, because if you look at the herring fishery over in Togiak, the Togiak herring fishery is the largest herring fishery in the state of Alaska. And what we have fishing over there? Just a handful of locals, mostly outside seiners, outside gill netters. And the cannery gets to pick who fishes and who doesn't. And you look at the price, and their price is the lowest in the state.
Well, when limited entry first came out, when they started issuing permits, I think the watershed residents owned about 40% or more.
More.
50%, yeah. Maybe, yeah. 50% of the permits were owned by watershed residents. I'm talking Ugashik, Igigig, Togiak, King Salmon in here, King Salmon, Naknekwijak in here. And now you go out there, since you could sell a permit, it made it hard on the ones who are in the fishery. Because if I'm out there fishing and I recognize Robin's boat, I could say, "Robin, you mind towing your buoy? It's coming a little close, and I'll tow my net too." Robin would say, "Yeah, you bet." 15-20 minutes. "Oh, we're all clear." "Okay." You do that from somebody from San Francisco, they're gonna cuss at you, and that's the way they fish. They're fighters, and it costs them so much to come up here. Maybe they bought a permit. Their partner's got to come up here. They got a large capital investment, and they're going to rape and run. And that was, that's the downfall of limited entry that I don't like. Because the locals, I could remember out here when I recognized just about every boat. Oh, here's so-and-so. He's running over to the west. Oh, here's so-and-so. He's going to the east. Oh, another guy, he must going to try down the line. Nowadays, you can't recognize those boats. They got $750,000 boats here. $750,000 boats. And the more we sell, the more we can't compete. And it's going to be a sad day in history one of these days when the locals are not going to be able to participate in this fishery. Why? They're selling their permits. And they're not selling them for medical reasons or the reasons that you hear, medical reasons or I had to feed my family. They're selling them to get that large chunk of cash. They go to Anchorage, and some of them, 6 months, they're looking for an airfare back. It's a sad case. Really a sad case. I hate to admit it, but that's the experiences I've seen with people selling their permits. I could see there's some isolated cases where older people have sold their permits. And that's good, retired. And a lot of them are selling to maybe their grandchildren. And some of them are giving it to them. And that's good. Maybe the grandchildren can help them with living expenses, oil or something. And that's good. I agree with that 100%. But out and outright sell to some stranger from Texas, I don't know.
What about the relationships, how the limited entry permit has changed kind of the relationships among families and that among crew members? And that's a big change too, right?
Oh, yeah.
So
it's split families.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. What impact has that had on the community in terms of limiting the number of people that can participate within the community?
Well, a drift permit, usually it's the permit holder and two other crewmen. And then a set net operation, it's usually the permit holder and one or two other crewmen. So it's usually three to a drift boat, three to a set net operation. And there's pretty much standard what you pay a crewman on a drift boat, what you pay a crewman on a set net. If my father died and there's three of us brothers, and all three of us brothers fished for Dad, he had three crewmen. When he dies, if that permit goes to one of the brothers, what happens to the other brothers? Either in a set net operation or drift. And we've seen families split over the ownership of a permit because it wasn't too many years ago a drift permit was going for $255,000, you know. And today you're seeing, I think a drift permit today is around $95,000 and a set net is around $38,000 right now.
Well, there's another detriment on limited entry. Like I said earlier, we had about 50% of the permits. You sell them, and the community hurts because those people, after they spend all the money that when they sold a permit, they don't have any money to live on. And so the community gets a hardship on because no way to make money. There's instances where a large family, has had three, four drift permits, probably as much set net permits, and they got nothing, absolutely nothing. A couple of families that I could name, and it's a sad situation. But even the community hurts, you know. You know, you want to buy a snow machine? Used to be, if you got a sign up with a company, even pre-limited entry, the superintendents would come in here, they'd buy you a snow go or give you an advance or all kinds of stuff. And those days are gone. Those days are gone.
Maybe we can take a little break and start the second half by talking about how you got to be involved and work to address some of these issues.